you're a CFII, and you'll be in the right seat of a Seneca piloted by your instrument student for a flight from Las Vegas to Vancouver, British Columbia. Less than an hour into the flight, turbulence reaches severe levels, and you've got to divert. The student got the weather briefing, but was it thorough? And it gets worse. Engine problems and wind shear at your divert airport threaten you as well. This is the first of three stories we'll hear from that same instructor on this episode of I Laughed. I learned about flying from that. Hello, everyone. I'm Rob Ryder, and welcome to episode 79 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco Insurance. My guest on today's program is a brilliant multilingual PhD who set aside a career in finance to become a flight instructor, an airshow pilot, and operator of a flight school, the Canadian Flight Center. What she learned from the flight in the Seneca and two other flights is important to all of us, irrespective of our level of experience. We'll meet Anna Serbenenko right after this message from Avemco. Avemco insured their first plane in 1961. Ironically, that same Cessna 172 became Avemco's first claim. That's what started them on a mission to improve pilot safety. They even reward safe pilots with reduced premiums. You'll save 5% just for caring enough about safety to be an I Learned About Flying from That listener. Visit avemco.com/flying. or call 800-338-8705 and ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance Specialist how you can save with the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Now, I learned about flying from that. Today on I Laughed, I have a lady with whom I have worked off and on for the last, 6 or 7 years when I met her flying a Super Decathlon in a very gentle, graceful aerobatic routine, almost silent flight compared to all the noise that we have at air shows. Her name is Anna Serbenenko, and Anna, welcome to I Laughed.
Hello, Rob. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are one of three ladies in our air show industry who have PhDs. Vicki Benzing in chemistry. She's with California Aeronautical University. Brittany Nielsen, the announcer, who is vice provost of an institution down in Florida. And you with a PhD. How many languages do you speak, Anna?
I speak 8 languages, Rob. And, well, I learned 12. I'm more or less fluent in 8. But my PhD is not in languages. I did it in financial mathematics in Karlsruhe in Germany.
Okay, now I hear the accent, and I know you're not from the United States, and you told me in our pre-interview that you were actually from Ukraine.
That's right. I was born and raised in Bakhmut in Ukraine, the city that unfortunately doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear that, and my prayers go out to you and your family and all those who are enduring what's going on there. But you are now living in Canada, and with your background in finance and your linguistic capabilities, what on earth got you into aviation? Can you tell me that story, please?
I'd be happy to share. I actually loved traveling, and even before I came to Canada 16 years ago, I have been pretty much on every continent except for Antarctica, not yet. I just wanted to take the plane and travel, and I didn't want to hire a pilot, I just wanted to do it myself. That was a passion of going somewhere and discovering new places. And 10 days after I immigrated to Canada, I took my first flight and then discovered there was more to it than getting from A to B. But there was this whole art of flying, regardless of getting somewhere, it's just the excitement of being in the air and being able to be free up there. And I got so hooked that I right away signed up for my private pilot license. I did not feel that I got enough training with it, so I continued with my commercial license. I still didn't feel like I had enough training, so I continued with my instructor rating. And I felt it was a good combination because by that time I had been instructing and teaching for about 10 years in high schools and universities as part of my research, part of my language and mathematics teaching. So flying and instructing, it was a good combination of teaching and flying. I continued with that and I thought I would do it only part-time on the side. And eventually it took over more and more and more. And I always enjoyed being independent and working for myself. So that's how I ended up having my own flight school that we have right now in British Columbia, Canada, Canadian Flight Center. Yeah, it has been a great journey of the last 15 years.
Where did aerobatics come into play for you?
A couple of years into instructing. No, let me backtrack. When I was still a pre-solo student in Canada, we are required to do spins. And when I was training, my instructor was a junior one, wanted to show off. And my whole preparation for the spin was something like, watch this.
Uh-oh. Those are the two worst words in the world for an aviator.
And the next thing I know, we're upside down. So it did scare me. It did put me off. I didn't like all the unusual attitudes. I was scared of them. I had to do them for my commercial license and my instructor rating, but I really wasn't comfortable. I was forcing myself to do it. So a couple of years into instructing, my partner was a flight school, Peter. He says, okay, let's take the plane and just go do some aerobatics. It's like, okay, I guess I trust you because I was scared of it. So we went up to the practice area and we did a loop. And it's like, well, that's not too bad. And then we did a roll. It's like, that's good. So by the time we landed back, I was hooked on aerobatics. That was love at first sight. And I did my aerobatic instructor rating within probably 1 month. That's a thing in Canada. I don't think there's a separate one in the United States for it, but I did it within 1 month. I had a few great instructors for it, both from the training side and the competition side, who were very experienced and competed high level. And when I started in the air shows, I had the privilege of having Bud Grandley as my mentor, and I have learned so much. I wouldn't be here if it was not for him.
What a great guy. As you got into air shows, that has a little bit to do with your first ILAF story that we want to talk about. And it involved bringing an airplane down from Canada, a Seneca, with a couple of other people to the International Council of Air Shows Convention in Las Vegas. Tell us about that story. How long ago was it? And guide us through what happened, because it really got a little bit dicey.
Yes. So that was the experience from I believe it was in 2014, 2015. It was not an air show airplane, not an air show performance. We came for the conference, and I was in the process of instructing a guy, I believe he was from France, towards his instrument rating. So he had never been to Vegas. He was interested. I got to spend a few days in Vegas at the conference, too. So we decided to combine and do his training on the way to and from Vancouver to Vegas and combine it with conference for me, vacation for him. So that was a great plan. The trip down from Vancouver to Vegas was uneventful. We did it in just under a day, great IFR conditions, a little bit of clouds, some VMC conditions, worked on the procedures, was awesome. On the way back was not so easy. So the last day of the conference, we usually have a banquet, and which ended probably the dinner ended between 7 and 8 p.m. So here I am coming still in my banquet dress to the airport. I checked all the whether the my student gave me the briefing as I was as we were headed for the airport. They prepared the plane. So I had my student who was working on his IFR, and I had my other student who was working on his instructor rating at that time, who was just backseating the flight. And we filed to depart from Vegas to Bend, Oregon. That was supposed to be about a 3-hour flight. And we thought we'd land there and evaluate how we, if we continue one more leg for a couple of hours to Vancouver, we stay for the night in Bend, Oregon. We had penciled in a hotel, but we were flexible with our plans at that time.
Nice to have options and nice to be thinking ahead about options. That's a good thing to do always.
Absolutely.
So you got to Bend, Oregon, and what happened?
Oh, we didn't get to Bend, Oregon. We only departed from Vegas. And the weather was clear, forecasted clear, and nothing major on our route, but there was a storm on the other side of the mountains in San Francisco area. And there was also turbulence forecasted above 18,000 feet somewhere in our area, but we were not going to go that far. We were probably in the 10 to 12,000 foot range for our trip planning. So all of that seemed to be a non-issue. The things didn't exactly happen as forecast. So within probably about 45 minutes from departing from Vegas, we got in the area of turbulence. We were always in clear skies, but the turbulence was definitely more than expected and probably the worst I've experienced in the Seneca to date.
Well, given that, your normal cruise speed in the Seneca would be how many knots?
Would be around 140.
Then you had to pull it back to about 115 for your maneuvering speed, I guess. Would that be correct?
That would be correct. Yet my GPS was showing anything from 80 to 220.
Wow.
And the altitude was going 1,000 feet up and down as we were trying to control the plane. The autopilot pretty much gave up on us, so I had to hand fly. And the reason I had to hand fly because my student who was supposed to be flying pretty much had a panic attack and checked out.
Oh boy. So you're in the right seat. You're not even in the seat you want to be in to hand fly in that kind of weather.
Absolutely not. So I'm trying to fly the instruments that are on the other side of the cockpit. I didn't have the full set of instruments on my side. And I'm hand flying and trying to figure out what am I doing here now.
Was your backseater any assistance to you in terms of navigation and communication and perhaps picking out a place to land?
Absolutely. So he couldn't reach the radios for the communication. So I had to fly and talk to the controllers myself. But he was of a great help to figure out that we definitely didn't want to continue another 2 hours in this condition. So we needed to find a diversion, a different airport to land. And he took the iPad that I was using for navigation figure out that it was Reno, Nevada was the nearest good option for us to go to. And that's what we advised the controller that we wanted to divert. And my backseat passenger was basically my navigator at that time.
What happened then as you diverted then to Reno? Because the story's not over yet, is it?
No, it's not. So we were given vectors to Reno. We were switched to the approach. And as we were coming in, there was a jet landing before us that reported a 55 knots of wind shear 500 feet off the ground.
Oh, boy. That exceeds the capability of the Seneca.
I think that exceeds capabilities of most planes.
Yeah.
So it was, I think, something like from 50 knots of tailwind to 5 knots of headwind or something pretty strong. So we are trying to stay higher. I'm approaching at a higher speed and to make sure that if we have a drop, we still stay well clear of the obstacle. And in the ocean of lights, It's not a huge city, but it's still a sizable city. And we were at night. So I didn't see the runway early enough to be able to descend and land on it safely on my first attempt to come in for landing. So I had to call and go around and try to do the approach for the second time. And just as if we didn't have enough for that evening, as we are climbing and we are being vectored for another approach, and I know there is higher terrain surrounding us, one of my engines decides not to quite cooperate, and I'm only getting partial power.
Wow. So not only do you have to deal with the turbulence, now you've got some differential thrust as well.
That is correct.
How did you handle it, and were you able then to continue the approach? Did you declare an emergency?
I did not declare an emergency because I think I was just so focused on the troubleshooting and following the vectors. I did ask them to give me, did ask the controllers to give me a shorter vectoring for final without having to climb higher above the terrain because I had difficulty climbing. Seneca, that was a Seneca 5, which is turbocharged, has a pretty good performance even on single engine. We were probably at that time somewhere 6 to 8,000 feet ASL. So it developed still even on sort of one and a half engine somewhat sufficient power, but I didn't want to have to go very high. So they were very helpful and vectored me in for final for my second approach in a shorter version of that approach. And the second approach was successful. We touched down, landed. We were not even considering the second leg that night.
I'm sure you weren't. Was wind shear still an issue on the second approach?
It was a bumpy approach. I cannot specifically tell what was the speed differential. I know I was just focused keeping my numbers and puppy lights to red, to white once we had the runway inside. And I was so focused just doing all those immediate corrections. When we vacated the runway before we taxied, I just paused for a moment. I realized my knees were shaking.
Oh, my goodness.
And yet I was still in high heels and the dress.
Well, we can talk about whether or not high heels are a proper thing to be using against rudder pedals in any airplane.
I'm performing in high heels at air shows. My flying boots are in high heels.
Well, then I stand corrected. Oh, my goodness. Anna, that's all right. That's the first one. Let's move on to the second one. And when we get through all three, we'll come back into all the I left takeaways on this. The second one, this involved a different airplane and some, but more tech, more mechanical difficulties. Set us up on that one. How long ago was it? And tell us about what happened.
The second story happened when I was working on my commercial license. So that would be in 09, summer of 09. And at that time, I was volunteering for the civilian search and rescue. So we would have regular training, and then we were occasionally called on various searches. It could be downed aircraft, lost hikers, lost vehicle somewhere in the mountains. So any source of search and rescue, we were doing the search part from fixed wing, and they would usually send helicopters for the actual rescue if required, or ground vehicles.
Were you flying like the Civil Air Patrol does, a single, like a 182 here in the United States, or what were you flying on this particular mission?
On that particular mission, we were flying an Air Commander. It's a twin high-wing 11-seater aircraft. Basically, the setup was that owners or even renters, people would bring whichever aircraft they had available, and the association was put into work where this aircraft was best suited for the type of task, be it search, be it hybrid. I would often fly a communication plane at 10 to 12,000 feet, helping to relay messages from down in the valleys. So in that particular flight, it was actually a training flight. And I was being trained because I had flown this plane from the right seat, more in a co-pilot role. And I was being trained to fly it from the left seat and land from the left seat. And also, it was a recurrency flight for the regular captain and owner of that aircraft to go through all the emergency exercises. So we were three people on board, myself, the experienced owner who was fixed wing and helicopter pilot, and a very experienced Air Canada captain who also was one of the volunteers for the search and rescue. And he was coaching and training us through all the procedures.
You've got all sorts of knowledge on board, right? And even with all that brain power, there was still a problem.
Absolutely. Sometimes it's just outside of our control. So the first part of the flight was going over the ocean and going through single engine procedures, single engine overshoot procedures, doing some steep turn stalls. And somewhere throughout this part of the flight, we see that the gear is down. And it's obviously visible. You have high wing, the gear is dropping from the wing, but the gear lever was up, so we didn't put it down.
Uh-oh.
And going through the checklist, it's an indication of a hydraulic failure. That's a fail-safe system in this aircraft because hydraulics is the blood of this plane. It controls flaps, steering, brakes, gear, everything. And if that system fails, a fail-safe item that will happen is that the gear will drop and lock with its weight so that at least you don't have to deal with the gear up landing.
Now, this was how long into the flight that this occurred, and were you still close to your home airport?
We were probably within 10 to 15 minute flight from the home airport. We were maybe half an hour to 45 minutes into the flight. So we were not that far, and our home airport was Boundary Bay in Canada near Vancouver. It was a relatively small GA airport. And the reason I'm mentioning it, that moving forward, and I'll explain it, will make sense, that not far from it, maybe within 20-minute flight or 15 to 20-minute flight, was Abbotsford Airport, which was a bigger airport with a bigger runway. So as we noticed the gear down, realizing we have hydraulic failure, we went through the checklist, did troubleshoot, confirm that, yeah, most likely that's what's happening. We have all indications for it. We didn't continue the exercises, decided to return. And this is where this decision came in. Get home-itis, I think, is known to every pilot.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And we knew that our maintenance was there, our hangar was there, our tools were there. So we decided to go back to Boundary Bay Airport we departed from. The power of the hindsight, we should have gone to Abbotsford Airport because it had a 9,600-foot runway, about 200-foot wide. So it's massive as opposed to 5,000 or 6,000-foot runway and 100-foot wide in Boundary Bay. Not a small one, but much smaller than it is in Abbotsford. What's most important, so as we were coming in, the owner of the plane, and that's another mistake, it's like, it was an issue before. He had this several years ago, a similar failure, and it was not an issue. It was a non-event. So he figured it will be a non-event this time also, kind of automatically assuming.
But if you've got no hydraulics and you don't have any flaps, that's going to change the numbers for landing and the amount of runway which you will chew up. But if you can't steer, if you don't have brakes, then you've got a problem with only 100-foot wide runway. Was that it? Did that become an issue in this landing?
Yes, it did. So without flaps, that plane had to be at 130 miles per hour over the threshold. So it's a fairly fast aircraft. We were right on the numbers. The checklist was saying that we might have one application of brakes. Might doesn't mean will. And actually, we didn't.
Oh, my.
after the touchdown, we had one correction of heading just using the engine power, after which we shut down the engines with mixture idle cut off immediately. And I have to say, so at this time, the owner and the experienced airline pilots were the ones sitting in the left and right seat, and I was right behind reading the checklist. So I was not in the controls of that one. I was very much participating, reading all the numbers.
Of course. CRM, let's hear it for good crew resource management.
Oh, we used every bit we could. And so after that one power correction, engines were shut down, mixture idle cut off. And the aircraft stayed on the runway maybe for another couple thousand feet, but then it did go off the runway. And the big, big issue in Boundary Bay is that it's not a flat surface. There are ditches. So the moment the aircraft was off the runway, it went into a ditch. And one of the landing gear, which is a, I don't know, 2-3 inch in diameter steel beam, was just sheared as if it was nothing. So we had this spar bent wing. I believe the nose gear collapsed too. Basically, the plane was a write-off at that time.
Had you gone to the other airport, you might have been better off.
In Abbotsford, not only the runways are twice the width, the grass is nice and flat on both sides of the runway.
We've got a lot to unpack on that when we get out from the break. Okay, that's two stories. The third one will bring it right back to air shows, I think, right? Is that what we're going to do?
I think so.
This one is very interesting to me in that we have talked about fuel starvation, and we've had a couple of episodes where people hadn't gotten the fuel cap back on the top or didn't pre-flight, or the fuel cap never got put back in after the airplane was refueled. But your experience in this was different. Kind of give us a rundown on how this fuel indication issue played out for you. When was it? Where were you flying? And were you in your decathlon?
Yes. So that story was just last year in my super decathlon. It was one of my practice flights. So every spring when the weather clears, we go back to the practice area and we work on our routines. We keep training all the time. So that was one of my training flights. And before going out, I'm at the fuel pumps, fueling the plane. And I just, like somebody who I know who I haven't seen for a while, is like, oh yeah, hi, how are you doing? And just came to me as I was fueling the plane. So we had a great chat with the person. In the process, I got distracted and I forgot to put the fuel cap back on. I do my run up, I take off, the plane goes flying, the fuel cap stays behind. And in the air, and this is my habit that really saved me that day, I'm always watching my fuel gauges.
Now, there's a very good reason for that in air shows, and you might want to explain it to everybody with respect to why you have to be so careful about fuel.
When we fly air shows, our routine, like my routine, is usually 8 to 10 minutes, and we want to present the best show we can with the aircraft, meaning that we want to have all the power, we want to have the minimal weight, and we only carry the fuel that we need for that flight at an air show. So we will never fly an air show with full tanks. And because of how little fuel we are carrying for the show, just what's required plus the legal reserve, we are always watching the amount of fuel we have in the aircraft. And also because air show situation is very unforgiving. If we have an issue with an aircraft at 5,000 feet, we have lots of time to figure things out. If you are upside down at 50 feet off the ground, you have much less options.
So true.
So fuel is critical.
It is indeed.
And I'm always in the habit of watching my fuel gauges. On the other hand, I also do a lot of cross countries over the mountains and without having too many options for landing for extended period of time. So fuel is always on my mind during the flight. And that day I was in the practice area doing my routines, practicing, polishing off, but maybe trying some new things. And then I keep an eye on my fuel gauges. And the fuel consumption seems to be more than usual, yet the engine, everything runs fine. And Decathlon is a high-wing aircraft, so I cannot see the tops of the fuel tanks and the fuel caps. So I continued for a little bit longer monitoring. Okay, maybe the indication wasn't correct. And then it keeps dropping. It's like, okay, I better safe than sorry. I'm just coming back. And my practice area is literally here less than 5 minutes from the home airport. So I returned, landed. Everything was uneventful. As I was flying, one of my tanks was indicating full tanks, while the other one was decreasing fairly quickly. After I landed, and that was a big surprise to me, that that fuel tank that was the entire time showing full fuel was actually the one that didn't have the fuel cap. And that's from which one the fuel was just siphoning out and flying out of the tank. So the not only I was losing fuel, but it's also the indication was very, very misleading.
Number one, glad you're back. Number two, nice to have a practice area that is very, very close to an airport, unlike an air show when you have a runway under you almost every second of a display. But we've got some things to discuss on that as well. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go through all three stories, get there, all the lessons learned, and figure out what you, Anna Serbinenko, learned about flying from that. We will be right back. Avemco is the only aircraft insurance company that lets you call them directly. In fact, they want you to call them. They love talking about airplanes, and if you've got a squawk with your insurance company, even if it's with Avemco, they want to hear about it. It's that direct one-on-one personal contact that sets Avemco apart. Visit avemco.com/flying or call them today at 800-338-8705. Say you're an I Laughed listener, and you'll save 5% on your annual premium. Now, back to I Laughed. We're back with Anna Serbinenko, Dr. Anna Serbinenko, PhD, and airshow pilot and instructor. And Anna, those three stories have presented a number of opportunities for lessons learned. Let's start with the first one in the Seneca, your trip back from Las Vegas en route to Canada. What did you learn about flying from that on that one?
You know, Rob, I have several points there. And my first one would be to always check the weather yourself. On that trip, I relied on my advanced student, but I kept guessing myself afterwards, if I phoned the weather briefer myself, would I have caught some indications that could have told me that the flight wouldn't be as smooth as planned? Second one would be use all the available resources. Yes, I sort of lost my pilot, my student pilot for that flight. By the way, he was perfectly fine afterwards. He was like, what was that?
You're the one whose knees were shaking and he's not understanding the gravity of the situation.
Not quite, but he eventually got his instrument ticket and he's professional pilot now. So despite the experience or thanks to the experience, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
But I had to use all the available resources. And at that time, it was obviously the ATC help and my passenger who was in the back, but who was capable to help me with the change of navigation after the flight. So that was the second lesson learned for me. It might be an unexpected source of help, but you take everything you can.
Let me ask you briefly, you talked about being on the other side and the idea of trying to read instruments at an angle with the parallax there. Was that a big challenge for you during your approaches?
That was a challenge, but it's also was not a huge one because I'm in the habit of practicing a lot even when I'm flying. And between me flying on my own with aerobatics and other flights and doing demonstrations when I am instructing, I was reasonably current on my hands and feet skills, which again would be my advice to all flight instructors, because it's very tempting to just sit back and only verbally correct the student. But hands and feet skills, stick and rudder skills, are perishable. And if we don't practice them, they are going away. So it helped me that I usually do take control of the aircraft on a regular basis.
Now we'll go to the Aero Commander. What did you learn about flying from that with respect to the hydraulic failure that occurred?
I do not think we could have prevented the hydraulic failure, because it's only something that is maintenance probably could have caught. It's not part of the walkaround. Where we could have done better as a crew is to make the decision to go at an airport that had the best chance for an uneventful landing. And it could have been Abbotsford, could have even been Vancouver International, which is has even bigger, even wider runway, flatter surfaces on both sides of the runway. But get home itis was a big decision there, a big factor there. And complacency. The owner, the PIC on that flight decided, well, I had it before, it was a non-event, so it will be fine this time. And one successful outcome doesn't guarantee all the future ones.
If it was a non-event, he probably didn't even think of the ditches on either side of the runway.
The last time, the previous time he had a similar hydraulic failure, he managed to keep the aircraft on the runway.
Glad you all walked away from it without injury, correct?
We just had a few bruises. We were fine. And which brings me to the next one. The airline captain who was with us the very next day grabbed me and made me go in my 172 for a flight without like getting back on the horse. And I think that was for me an important factor of just continuing flying, because it was definitely a dramatic event to have the that big of a plane written off, all damaged, my first crash in my life and the last one so far. And I don't want to have this experience again.
Absolutely not.
The fact of going back in the air the very next day, taking off right beside the crash site of the previous day, was a psychological effort, but it was an important one to keep flying.
Good to hear. The distraction issue that can happen to anybody, but that was something that I think really got your attention, and it has probably changed how you do each and every pre-flight that you do. Would that be correct? What do you do now differently? What did you learn about flying from that in the Super D when you started losing gas?
I think it's not even about the walk around, because it was done properly before. My biggest lesson learned from that event was when we talk about a sterile cockpit below 10,000 feet, in my point, it should include the ground.
Wow, that's a good one. That is very good.
So if I'm in the aircraft moving and fueling is part of moving, part of the operation, that's me already being on my flight. My focus is on what's operational in that aircraft. And yes, I am below 10,000 feet, and that includes the ramp.
That's very interesting in that in the air show business, there has been over the years an observation that a pilot that's going to be in an air show needs at least a 30-minute bubble where nobody bothers the pilot at all, so he or she can focus totally on putting an airplane up in front of a crowd near the ground and pushing an aircraft to the edge of its envelope. So that bubble, that ability to only focus on the flight, only focus on the mission is critical. And it's interesting that it would apply to those of us who don't have to do that kind of edge of the envelope flying.
In my opinion, that would apply to every flight, and be it an IFR flight, training flight, first solo flight, any distraction has the capacity, and even our mechanics here on the floor who repair the aircraft, if they get distracted, they have the rule that they are going 3 steps back in whichever task, whatever project they were doing, to avoid exactly that. So we try to keep their bubble and not let students distract mechanics, for example. So distraction is a big challenge, and it's up to us to be in control for not allowing it. And there's always time to say we go for a coffee after the flight with the friends.
Absolutely. Those are great incidents to share what you learned about flying from that. Thank you so much, Anna Serbenenko, for being on ILAF.
Thank you very much, Rob. It was my pleasure.
Anna's Flight School is the Canadian Flight Center. They've got locations in Vancouver and Kamloops, British Columbia. Their website is cfc.aero, Charlie Foxtrot Charlie, dot Alpha Echo Romeo Oscar. Again, I thank Anna for being a guest on the podcast and bringing us such great lessons. Keep your stories coming. I've enjoyed chatting with each of my guests, and I'd like to hear your story as well. My email address is rob@flying.media. rob@flying.media. Thanks again for listening, and I hope if you haven't done so, you will subscribe and share it with your friends. ILAFT is available wherever you get your podcasts. We drop episodes every couple of weeks, so you can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. Kate O'Connor is managing editor of Flying Magazine, and Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of ILAFT. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.